In the desert oasis where stories ignite, Skip's little bar, a beacon of light. From the Coachella Valley stars to cool everyday Joes, join Patrick and Randy, let the stories flow. At Big Conversations Little Bar, the magic spreads near and far. Backed by the McCallum Theater's grace, celebrate the voices that shape this place.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar at the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence, presented by the McCallum Theater. Visit McCallumTheater.org or reach the box office at 760-340-2787. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Howard, very much. We are back here at the coveted corner booth. My name is Patrick Evans, and you're listening to Big Conversations, Little Bar. And I'm here with my trusty sidekick, the greatest co-host since the invention of podcasts, Mr. Randy Florence.
6 months ago.
How are you, Randy?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Yeah?
We're sitting here in an iconic place, Little Bar.
It is.
And as we record this, we're kind of in festival season.
Festival season
La Quinta.
Is in full swing.
And it always seems to center around here at some point during that time.
I have a sneaking suspicion that all of the headliners show up here. Like, I suspect that Lady Gaga was here a lot. We just didn't know about it.
I'm still pretty certain that was Kylie Jenner sitting behind me during last week's episode.
Oh, might have been.
Yeah.
Very, you know, well, look, Skip. Is Skip.
Skip Page.
Skip is Skip Page. So we are here, and Wells Marvin is our guest today. Welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Patrick.
Obviously, you've been in the Valley, you told me, just 28 years, is that right?
Right.
So what brought you to the Coachella Valley? Was it strictly an economic play, like you saw a place that was ripe for development?
Basically, I'd been developing, I'd been living in the Bay Area in Los Altos Hills, and was developing up in Oregon, where I'd gone to University of Oregon undergrad, so I knew Eugene well, and things were kind of going too well in Eugene. I am always a little bit of a contrarian. When things go really well, I want to, you know, see what the next opportunity is. Actually, where I got the idea to come down here was by watching the Lexus Challenge, which was a senior tour event of the day at the Citrus. And so I was on a rainy afternoon watching that one rainy Sunday afternoon in the Bay Area in Los Altos, and thought, wow, it looks like great weather there. And so I made some contacts. Somebody suggested I call Bruce Blomgren, who was at the time probably still the top realtor in the Valley. And so I came down and met him. He showed me around, and I ended up buying a condo within a few weeks at right behind La Quinta Resort.
Now, at that time, I would imagine, and when I got here, not too long after you, 23 years ago, there were still a lot of open places and a lot of developable land, far less so today.
Right.
What made you pick where you put Old Town La Quinta? What said to you, this is kind of the ripe spot?
Well, that was a kind of a second step. I really had gotten into the Urban Land Institute and new urban planning, and gone to a lot of the pilgrimages to Seaside, Florida, and to Harbor Town in Memphis and other places like that. And, you know, I wanted to do something that was very urban, either whether it was residential or commercial. And I saw what was then, still is, the village of La Quinta. There was practically nothing there. It was laid out in 1920s when they laid out about 5,000 lots in the Cove, which are, of course, still there. And they laid out 110 acres of commercial. And that's what planted the seed, but that's not why I came here. I came to develop homes. I built $100 million of homes at the Citrus, at the Greg Norman Course, and then at the Reserve in Indian Wells between 97 and 2004.
And those were pretty good growth years here.
Right. They turned out to be. We were very fortunate when we started. My vice president of the company moved down first, and then I followed him in the fall of 97. And, things were just turning. In fact, we commissioned a study by a company called the Myers Group at that time, and it said there was no market at all, period, for homes over $1 million in La Quinta. And I intuitively didn't think that was right. I went and met with Tom Cullinan, who's still here in the Valley at the Reserve, met him out at Rancho La Quinta, and looked around, and I thought, you know, there was the demand for homes of $1 million or more. And we just hit, the timing was, you know, to some degree lucky, and I think we had some skill in it, and we designed some beautiful homes, and it went from there.
Well, it really is striking to me that you're sitting in the Bay Area watching sunny La Quinta right. on your television, then suddenly, at the same golf course, you actually got to develop and build homes there.
I did. That was just very fortunate coincidences. I happened to meet Larry Lichtleiter, who was the L in KSL. Unfortunately, he passed away about 13 years ago, and he became, got to know him, he became one of my best friends and mentors, and I was able to buy land from KSL and develop homes on the same course. And then I ended up, the next year, played in the Lexus Challenge with Gary Player and Johnny Miller and some other people.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so it was kind of a full circle moment there.
Oh, I got to dig in on that. Johnny Miller was notably a character. So what was it like playing golf with him?
He was fantastic. He had the reputation of being that friendly and he hadn't putted well. I think he'd gotten off the tour because he was having trouble putting. He played incredibly well that day. He was fantastic. Gary Player took me on as a project. Probably at that time I was a 27 handicap. If I was anything, I was pretty much a kind of a new golfer, having just joined the Citrus. But Gary Player, coached me around 9 holes, which was nerve-wracking.
I was going to say,
him. Yeah,
that's crazy. But how did it help your game?
Following through, he was big on kind of walking through the ball as you hit it, and that probably was one thing that stuck with me. But he was very intense.
I can only imagine.
And still in unbelievable shape.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I've had a chance to meet him a couple. I mean, but that's a kind of thing that really doesn't happen very many places. This valley is one of the few places where that kind of experience gets to happen to folks.
Yeah, and later I was able to play in 2005. I played in the Bob Hope. And I had a great pairing with Drew Brees and Marshall Faulk. And then I played with Jasper Parnevik, Mike Weir, Corey Pavin.
Oh, my goodness.
And those are some names.
Yeah, and then on the Saturday, I played with Justin Leonard. And he shot 8-under that day, I think 9 birdies, 1 bogey. And then I walked with Amanda, his wife, the next day. And I said, he's going to win. And he hadn't won for quite a while. He'd won the British Open, obviously, but hadn't won for quite a while. Walked with him at PGA West, and for about 2 weeks after there, had a lot of calls from people like, what are you doing on national TV playing golf?
Up in the Bay Area?
I played some in the Bay Area. I have played Los Altos Hills. I played Los Altos Country Club, but I didn't play a lot up there.
Great courses.
It was sporadic, yeah.
You got into the business you're in at a very early age.
I did.
I read a story where you got you had a little inheritance money and you got a loan.
I started between my freshman and sophomore year at University of Oregon. I built a duplex.
Yeah.
Had a good friend who was a builder who literally showed me, we poured the foundation, we poured the walkways, the driveway, we framed the whole house, we hung the cabinets, we hung the doors. So I literally learned the business from ground up, which was very useful, especially later after I graduated from law school and practiced construction real estate litigation in depositions. I knew, I didn't know more than the builder, but I knew a lot more than the builder's attorneys.
So what drove you in that direction? I mean, you're in college, in a fun college town, but what was pushing you to do the construction thing and the real estate thing?
Well, I'd always planned to go into the U.S. Foreign Service.
My father was
a career diplomat. I was born overseas in Berlin, in the American Army Hospital in Berlin in 57, before the wall went up.
Wow.
Was there for 3 years, and we left when I was 3, so I don't really have a lot of memories of it. But so I wanted to be a diplomat and pass the exams, but then at that time I was building, and I was making really good money, and, as a 20-year-old making 20 or 30,000 a year building houses, and in those days was real money.
That's real, yeah.
Yeah, in the mid 70s, and I stayed in development, although it was rough because when Volcker put up interest rates in 79 to 19-20%, prime was at 20 or 21, and I remember I tell younger people this now that some builders and I would meet every Wednesday for coffee, 4 or 5 of us. And we sit around talking about if interest rates would only come down to 12%, boy, would we sell a lot of houses. And And they didn't come down to that, and we didn't sell a lot of houses. And by 83, I ended up packing up all my belongings in a U-Haul truck and driving to California and moved to Los Gatos.
See, I was smart enough to get into the mortgage business when prime was at 21.
Yes.
But I didn't know. That's just what interest rates were at the time.
Yes, exactly.
You know, when you look now at current economics, and I think people are still pretty vociferously complaining about 6% and 7% interest rates. And I get that. I mean, we locked in at, I think, 3.25 or 3, mm-hmm. something like that, when, you know, when those rates were ridiculous. And I was mad because we missed the 2.75. I mean, did you ever imagine that interest rates would drop to those kinds of levels when you were, you know, first looking and you know,
no.
talk?
No, no. I think if you look at the historical averages on the 5-year, the 10-year treasuries and everything, you know, they're in the 6 to 6.5% range. They may go, certainly they have gone lower, and they've gone quite a bit higher. I think business is doable at 6-7%. I think at 10-12%, unless you have big inflation, it's just not economic to build things. And in fact, I'm not sure anything is economic to build right now.
Yeah, is that
especially
right?
Especially in California.
Well, just the costs of construction have gone up so much, the labor rates, the materials, and they're going to go up more for
yes.
two reasons. One, because of the tariffs, they'll go up, and also because of the fires in L.A., unfortunately. I mean, there's 16,000 new homes or homes that need to be rebuilt, really, so new homes that need to be built in that area, and that's going to just suck up all the labor in California and all the materials, and, of course, we need a lot more other housing, too.
Well, I've heard sort of secondhand stories that projects out here, like the builders who are working in Cotino now, are focusing on, you know, going back over to the Palisades. Like, there's just not enough builders and workers and, to go around, and that's going to be a giant project to rebuild those portions of L.A.
I'm not actively building anything in the Valley right now, but yeah, I, of course, still have a lot of friends that are in the business, and that's what I'm hearing is people are adding on, you know, 20% to what their cost might have been, you know, last fall to what they think it's going to be going forward.
Now, I want your insight on this. When you look at the swath of L.A. that burned, particularly in the Palisades, that was a pretty old neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
They can never build it back to the standards where it was before. I mean, all the regulations, all the rules, all the zoning, I mean, all of that has changed to a degree.
Well, I'm no expert on this subject, and you say that they're pretty old houses. Well, you know, in Greece, they wouldn't be considered old houses. I can tell you that much.
That's true. That is
considered
true.
Quite new houses. But, yes, a lot of them, I think, were built in the 40s and 50s. And, yes, the standards have definitely changed. The seismic standards, the reinforcing they need, the energy standards, they have to meet Title 24. But they'll be allowed, as I understand it, to, you know, not comply with the current zoning or setbacks. If there's now, a 10-foot setback from the side yard, if they had 5 feet, they're going to allow them to build back to
On the footprint.
That's what I understand from
I can't imagine them not doing that, because that would be so prohibitive,
right?
You know, for the rebuilding,
right? But the cost will be, you know, exponentially more. And a lot of the people were not insured, fully insured, and so I don't know. I mean, now apparently a lot of people are starting to sell lots.
Yes.
But, you know, do you want to buy a lot in an area where you're going to, if you build a house and finish it in the next 18 months or 2 years, you're going to be one of the few houses around while there's kind of all this deficit, basically kind of a war zone around you.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, we've been hearing about a lot of those people coming here and building, buying and building here.
Yeah, I've heard of some renting. I haven't really, yeah, maybe a few here and there have been buying, apparently, because a lot of people, of course, there's still people in this country that have to go to work each day, and so they need to stay near their jobs in L.A., and some of them can work remotely, but, you know, probably only temporarily, so I'm not sure that's going to be a big push out here, despite what some of the realtors might want to tell you.
Well, when I was running the chamber, we were pushing that.
Yeah.
Work from home and come to the desert.
Yes.
Well, there was a lot of that during, I mean, COVID did see a big outflow from the big cities, L.A., San Francisco, yeah. to the Coachella Valley and other places.
Landers.
Well, I think the whole valley is, I mean, really gotten to critical mass, and we can talk a little bit more about this. But, you know, it's hard to put your finger on when it happened. You know, coming here and in 97. I mean, in the summer, you could drive down 111. Most of the restaurants were closed. You know, there was happy hour at Palomino, and there was happy hour everywhere, but not everywhere, but most of the places were closed, but a few places were open, Cliff House and things like that. And now it's
and
become...
that's where everybody went.
Right.
That Palomino.
Right, exactly. Well, they had great, you know, like $5 appetizers, if I remember rightly, but that was dinner for my vice president of my company and me when we first came down here, and we were walking every project and around. But no, something has really changed. Again, I don't know if it was 5 years ago or 8 years ago, so people have different opinions, but between things like Thermal Racetrack, the Acrisure, you know, arena, yeah, not only the hockey and the sports there, but also the all the concerts and everything else they have, you know, whether it's rodeo or whatever, all the, I mean, there always were a lot of events out here. And of course, you know, when I think talking about Skip and Coachella and Stagecoach, I think they started in 98, correct me if I'm wrong, but in there, 98, and right about the time I got here, maybe a year later, and I thought that was probably the dumbest idea I'd ever heard of, having a concert out here. I was sure
it would... for the first couple of years, they thought the same thing.
Yeah, they did. I thought it would completely flop, and so I'm often wrong. So.
So you weren't a major investor.
No, I was not an investor, unfortunately, whatsoever. But
but you're more often right.
Well, you know, I think any developer who tells you that they haven't made some bad investments is a liar.
All right. As a developer, talk about the invaluable experience with the work that you did in law.
I don't know if it was it was all that valuable. I think it makes you realize, well, you're no longer impressed by, you know, I think I stopped being impressed by lawyers when I became one. I stopped being impressed by millionaires when I became one. But
oh, I'd like to get to that.
That'd
be nice.
I can't wait to get to that point.
I'm still pretty impressed by millions.
Now I think you have to be a billionaire now. Apparently, that's the latest thing.
Haven't flown in space.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
But anyway, I think it helped me probably see issues more. I probably use more attorneys now than I would otherwise, because you're taught in law school to spot issues. And it made me, I was always very, intuitive, but also very impulsive. And so it made me a lot better thinker, to be more methodical about things. And so I think it definitely helped in business, but it's hard to put your finger on. It's an intangible to some extent.
Now, we'd gotten to the point you were building homes, making pretty good money, and then that stopped at some point.
Well, in Eugene, things just, you know, completely collapsed. Things got a little better in 81 when rates came back down. I built 11 homes in 81, and then by 83, things just started to fall apart again, moved to the Bay Area, built some what I call I made it homes, you know, I built big houses in the hills. And I also built Victorian replicas in downtown Los Gatos.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Even modeled one. My great-grandfather was a builder in San Francisco in the 1880s and 90s. It made his reputation because all his houses stood
up
during the earthquake of 1906. He literally had jumped ship. He was Irish. Literally had jumped ship as a ship's carpenter in San Francisco Bay because he found out he could make six times more being a carpenter in 1880 in San Francisco than he could being a ship's carpenter. So he literally jumped ship and stayed there, and that's half of my family.
Oh, that's how half of the family got to California.
Well, no, yes, that's part of the family had gotten there. Some of it had, they'd been in Berkeley for a long time. And then my grandfather, my father's father, was a lawyer, and my grandmother was a doctor. So I'm not a doctor, but I got the lawyer and the builder part down.
Well, there's still plenty of time. Medical school.
So you talked about going back to Old Town, the design, the way you looked at it. How much of that was formed by what you saw when you were growing up in parts of Europe?
Well, I wanted to do something kind of a human scale. I find that a lot of the U.S. is very inhuman, if that's the right word, or alienating. Like, I mean, generally shopping centers and big malls and big high-rise buildings are not very warm and cuddly.
They're not communities.
They're not very communities. Yeah. And, you know, I've spent not only time living in Europe, but also traveling in Europe a lot. And so I wanted to do something that was very walkable and more of a human scale. That's why it's only two-story. It's really more of a residential scale from my background as a high-end, you know, home builder. To my detriment, to some extent, because I way overbuilt it. I went way over budget on everything, and it's way too well built, if you will. But it seems to be resonating with people. But I wanted to do something that to create a real downtown where there was no downtown. In fact, arguably, you know, a lot of places like well, the mayor of Rancho Mirage once called the river their downtown. Well, it's a shopping center. It's not really a downtown.
Right.
I mean, excuse me. You know, El Paseo is nice, but I think it's too wide. It's kind of it's hard to go with it. So I wanted to have it so you could walk down one side of the street, and if you see something you like, you could easily cross the street, and people aren't rushing by in four lanes of traffic. So yeah, we tried to make it a human scale, and you know, it's become the heart and soul of La Quinta, and it's literally the main street. There's another story there, but.
And we're going to get to that story. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our presenting sponsor, the McCallum Theater. Don't forget, the season gets longer and longer. They're adding shows even as we speak. Check out McCallumTheater.org, and let's hear from them right now.
The McCallum Theater's 2025 season is on sale now. The world's top artists, from jazz, pop, classical, and comedy to the best of Broadway, only at the Valley's favorite place for great entertainment. Tickets are on sale now at the McCallum Theater's box office, by phone, or online at McCallumTheater.org. Tickets sell quickly, so order yours today. It's an exciting season only at the McCallum. Your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater.
You learn important things in commercial breaks.
You do.
So you were on the board of the McCallum with President Ford.
I was.
So that
yes.
goes back a few years.
Yeah, that was in the 2001, 2000 to 2005, something like that. I remember I was head of the facilities committee because of my background in construction and in construction litigation. And I remember we had a presentation about some improvements we were going to do one day, and I had to give the presentation. And after some other questions from other board members, President Ford leaned forward, and he said, "Wells, I have a few questions." And, "Yes, Mr. President." And that makes your heart kind of stop for a minute when you're facing a former president, and he's asking you questions. But he asked excellent questions. He was always one of the had the best questions of anybody on the board and was always totally engaged and totally supportive with McCallum. And I know he's much missed by McCallum.
Oh, absolutely.
It must be pretty nice from going back then to see what that theater means to this community now.
Well, I think it has since it was built. It means a lot. I still have a picture of him and me on the my desk that was taken up at Bighorn during an event where my job was to escort him up to other people that were there for the event and introduce them, etc. And a lot of people come in and say, is that your dad? And I actually don't have a picture of my dad on my desk. I should. But I say, no, just look more carefully.
All right. We were talking about Old Town and how you designed it to be more human, more habitable, more walkable. And you draw on that. You grew up in Europe. And talk a little bit about it. Your dad was in the Foreign Service. He was a diplomat.
He was a career diplomat.
And so you spent most of your youth?
Not most of my youth. I also lived in Bethesda, Maryland when my father was, back at the State Department and had various jobs there. My mother was a war bride from England. My father had been a captain in the Army Air Corps and went into Omaha Beach on the 11th day.
Wow.
Not under fire or anything, to be clear. But, I had obviously visited England a lot, too, where things are, again, more of a human scale, a more of a residential scale, that even the commercial is mostly more of a, residential scale.
It's interesting, I think. We build things so differently in the United States because we separate out, and I guess we zone it a lot this way, that there's commercial and there's residential, so you don't get a lot of mixed use. There's more and more of it. But, Europe is universally, you kind of live, work, shop, all in kind of similar areas.
Yeah, I don't know where the U.S. lost its way on architecture and urban design, somewhere in the maybe post-World War II, and they felt like they had to separate the industrial areas were in one area, or even the warehouses, and then the downtowns were another area, the houses or housing was in a different area, so everybody has to commute between, so we had to build all these massive roads and freeways, and people waste a huge amount of time on the freeway. I mean, you just have to look at, Temecula, the number of people that commute from Temecula to North County, San Diego, or even San Diego each day because they want to live, it's less expensive and they want to have the kind of the countryside. But there's very little industry around Temecula.
Yeah, there's nothing. No office. It's all horse country there, I guess.
Well, yeah.
And the Bay Area, they were all, I mean, they got to some point where people were working in Silicon Valley, but buying homes in Los Banos, because that's where they had to go.
Some. A lot of them also, it used to be that San Francisco, everybody would commute in the 60s into the city, and it became a reverse commute because all the people who worked in high tech wanted to live in the city and be, you know, more gentrified in the city, and they would, you still see the buses coming out of the city every morning down to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, the growth up there has been insane, and talk about exponential cost going up.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's super expensive. This is, I think, the Coachella Valley is probably one of the nicest places left in California, which is still affordable. Now, I know it's still not affordable for some people, but it's much more affordable than a lot of places in California because, you know, maybe Los Banos or maybe Fresno or Bakersfield is maybe less expensive than here. I don't know if it is.
But then you're living in Bakersfield.
I wouldn't want, yeah, exactly. I wouldn't want to live in those places. So it's, you know, and it's really a diversity of not only incomes, but housing here. I mean, you literally have everything from single wide trailers to things at the Vintage or Bighorn or Madison Club.
Now, you built very high end homes when you came here in some really wonderful communities.
Well, today's standards, they probably wouldn't be super high end, but they were $1 million to $2.5 million, yes, and now they're maybe $2 million to $4 million.
But what's the high end in the valley these days? I don't know.
Well, I think
Cat City.
Yeah, certainly not. No, I think they let me move there, so it can't be.
The most expensive ones are probably in the, you know, anywhere from $16 to $35 million at Madison Club. Certainly, the Reserve has some beautiful, beautiful homes. I was a member there for 5 years and built 10 homes there, and incredible development. But there's, I guess high end would be $10 to $30 million.
Wow.
That's the other really cool thing about La Quinta, of course, is you've got all of that. You've got the lower end properties, but everybody's meeting up as a community in Old Town and stuff like that.
Right. And so you mentioned there's a story behind why that is Main Street.
Well, so I wanted to call it Main. There was no Main Street in La Quinta. And so it was logical, if I'm going to build the downtown, I'd want a Main Street. So the story that one of the former city managers told me, who's since passed away, is that the day after the whole thing was approved, that the city council approved Old Town unanimously, that the former mayor, Don Adolph, who had been in Rotary with me, he asked the then city manager, he said, "Let me understand this. Did we agree to name the street that goes through the middle of Wells' Old Town project Main Street?" He goes, yes, you did, Mr. Mayor. "Well, now, so is Wells going to own the Main Street of La Quinta?" "Yes, he is, Mr. Mayor." He said, "Damn it, Wells got another one over on us."
But now you have created, I mean, as you pointed out, there was no downtown in La Quinta. And a lot of our desert cities are like that. And I live in Cathedral City, and we have a downtown, but it's it doesn't really exist as a downtown.
It's never really gelled. And that's the beauty of Old Town, is that it was done with not one dime of subsidy by the government. You know, they were helpful on approving it and things like that, but not one dime of money was ever put in by the government was put into Old Town. Where Cathedral City, my understanding is, and I could be wrong, as I have been on other things, that the city has put millions and millions and millions of dollars into developing a downtown in Cathedral City, and whether it was badly planned or ill-conceived or not well executed, I'll leave it to other people to decide. But it just seems to me, driving through there, even going to the IMAX, you know, years ago and all that, that it's never really gotten that pedestrian element that you need for a real downtown.
Well, I think one of the big issues is, you know, you have this development on Highway 111, and there's some really wonderful, I mean, they're terrific. There's some great restaurants, and now CV Rep, the Mary Pickford, all of those are great traction. But then directly across the street, you have a lot of unused or just kind of odd I don't want to say terrible because I lived in the city, but it's not great right. on well, that south side of 111.
But if you look at any number of downtowns, you can only keep that energy going so long. If you look at Pasadena, the downtown, you can't, there's Colorado Boulevard and stuff, but it goes for 3 or 4 blocks, but it's hard to go for 8 or 12 blocks.
Right.
You've got to concentrate the energy. I looked, I think 10 years ago, the mayor and the planning director invited me down to Indio and to look at, could I do something like in Indio, like I'd done at Old Town La Quinta? And it was just, I felt too disjointed. They owned a lot of parcels of land, but the way it was laid out and the way the parcels were in the existing buildings, now they're doing a lot right now. And I think they're trying hard and there will be the right time. But it's unique, and that's the thing about Old Town is I was able to buy 6 acres that had been assembled by somebody else from little 25-foot wide lots, 50-foot wide lots. So I was able, there were 6 acres already assembled because most people can't do that. And the advantage I have over El Paseo is I have a unified ownership. So we can do events like our Art on Main Street. We can do the farmer's market every Sunday that we have. We can curate all the tenants. So we don't have, 10 women's shoe stores, or we don't have 10 ice cream stores or whatever, because we purposely pick who we want to have come in. Unfortunately, we have a waiting list of people that want to come in there. And so we don't, we make sure the restaurants have a diversity of offerings, and we have different price ranges. We have really something for everybody. The biggest regret we have is that it looks almost too nice. And some of the locals, we really want to encourage the locals to come down this summer, because sometimes locals go, it's too nice, it's going to be too expensive. A woman might say, I don't want to go there to get a top because, it's probably everything is $400. Well, we do have a store that has tops that are $400, but we also have stores that have tops that are $20 or $30, no more expensive than anywhere else in the valley. So
my wife hasn't found those.
Much to your chagrin.
The higher one, she's found that.
My wife the same, but yes.
I had my 50th birthday party at Hog's Breath.
Wow, you're dating yourself.
I know, I'm dating myself. But I think we were born the same year, 57?
Correct, yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, I'll tell you a story about Hog's Breath, which was partly owned by Clint Eastwood.
Right.
And one night I was there with a gentleman who I had lunch with today, Tom Kirk, who's the Coachella Valley Area Government's CBAG. Director, CBAG. And he was on the city council of La Quinta at the time, and we were having I was living in France at the time, but came back and we had dinner about 8 o'clock one night, and Clint and Dina, his ex-wife, came in because they liked to come in late so they wouldn't be bothered, which didn't always work. But anyway, Lee Marcus, who is the one who ran Hog's Breath, took me over to introduce me to Clint because I'd never met him. And he said, sit down for a minute, Wells. I sat down with him in his booth for a few minutes. And he said, Wells, what I really, really love about Old Town is it reminds me of Carmel. And I said, Mr. Eastwood, I really appreciate that, not because you're Clint Eastwood, but because you were mayor of Carmel, so you really get it. And that was my intention when I did it, was to create Carmel in the desert. Because when I lived in the Bay Area, I'd often go down there on weekends for either the weekend or just for the day, and just love the whole look and feel of Carmel.
It's the most charming place. I mean, that is Carmel is just it's a little bit of magic.
And as you say I can see it. But I can see the similarities.
But it's magic because it's authentic, yes. And it has even though it doesn't have unified ownership, it has a good mix of tenants and shops and the things are unique. The thing is that when I travel, you go to any shopping center and they all have the same things, most of the same things that are like on El Paseo. And, the chain stores, which is fine. But the reason we like people to come to Old Town is if they're flying back to Seattle, they come down for a week or two from Seattle, the stuff they're going to find at Old Town, they're not going to just find on Amazon. They're not going to find in Seattle because it's not a chain. We don't have chains. They're boutiques.
So, and you talk about a unified ownership and how you curate what goes in there. How do you guys control that, and how much control do you have of it? Is it absolute?
Well, I'm the one that controls it. I have silent partner investors, but I control it absolutely along with my property manager. We don't have to let anybody in, we've had people approach us, nothing wrong with it, for vape shops and, you know, cell phone stores and all that.
And you're like, no.
That's fine. And we just a hard no on that. We, you know, like a vape shop or tattoos, piercings. Fine. I mean, there's a need for that. We'd love to have a cannabis store, because that's pretty mainstream. Plus, they pay a lot of rent. But the city of La Quinta is, you know, giving away their tax dollars to all the other cities, and all the other cities have mobile delivery and have cannabis stores. So, but the city council won't budge on that.
So, talk about your relationship with the city council. I mean, obviously, you've got approval to do the project, and it has grown beautifully over the years. You exercise control over the tenants and the properties. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with the city right now. It, you know, are there things that they want? Obviously, they don't want the cannabis shops, but are there things that they have said, "Hey, could you throw one of these in?"
And no, they're not really that proactive on those kind of things and trying to recruit, you know, new businesses or anything. I mean, we have a good relationship. I know all the city council members on a first name basis. In fact, we had pretty much, I think, all of them to a little event last Tuesday for Art on Main Street to thank the city for their support for our marketing, and to thank Shelley, who's now been there for 9 years running Old Town, and she's taking a break, running AOMS, Art on Main Street, and she's taking a break. And it was, the mayor thanked me. She said it was a lovely lunch, and it was a chance for people to speak and talk about the arts. John McMillan, who's the city manager, I talk to him, meet with him, text him about things when necessary, and he's been, very responsive. One thing we'd really like to do is do what they call an entertainment zone in La Quinta.
Santa Barbara did that. Did they? Yeah, they created, they took some properties that I think were in a bit of disrepair and turned one street into, and they call it the entertainment and fun zone.
Right, but this is something a little different. This is a new law that was just put in January 1st by the state of California, allowing people to get drinks and then walk around an area so they don't have to stay behind a fence like they do currently at a restaurant. Something that Palm Springs may want to consider or may not want to consider. It's up to each city. But so each city can pass an ordinance that allows an entertainment zone, define the boundaries of it. And then we would have to go to ABC and get approval so somebody could go get a drink at the Grill on Main. They could go get a drink at, the Roadrunner
or tequilas
or any, stuff, pizza anywhere. And they could walk around. Whether we'd like to see that all the time. Because we're not, we don't have the Hell's Angels and 1,000 bikers drinking beer. We have pretty much, we have just regular law-abiding people walking around drinking Chardonnay or whatever. and during the art show, we just think it would make for a better experience. And, we'd like to try it.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, I'm sure you've spent some time in New Orleans where you can just get a drink anywhere and walk around. And
I actually is one major U.S. city I've never been to is New Orleans.
Really?
Yes, never. Oh. But I'd like to go sometime, but I haven't got around to it.
Well, that was one of I grew up in Virginia, and we had, when I grew up there was
Where in Virginia?
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay, beautiful, yes. UVA.
Yeah.
I wanted my daughter to go there, but she went to WashU in St. Louis instead. The architecture school is fantastic at UVA because it was designed by Jefferson himself.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Monticello is one of my favorite places, and Jefferson's one of my heroes.
Mine, too. I was always glad that I went to Mr. Jefferson's University.
Yes.
My dad taught there for 40-plus years in the engineering school.
I'm going back to Fresno City. I'm trying to remember famous alumni.
I'm sure Thomas Jefferson thought about Fresno.
He did.
Said the same thing. Fresno. It's the city that answers.
Well, he bought the Louisiana Purchase. He was working his way to Fresno.
That's right.
If you will, he opened the door. He opened the door.
Got there.
He opened the door to Fresno. Let's put it that way.
I heard that Lewis and Clark they did stop at the mouth of the Columbia River, but then they went down to Fresno to hang out for a couple days.
So, based on all of your law knowledge, your construction knowledge, your development knowledge, what's your feeling about what's going on at the Silver Rock project and whether anything's ever going to finalize there?
That's a great question.
Well, I always say to people, I think forever is a long time. So I suspect that at some point, something will happen. My personal opinion is, as much as I was very supportive of it, because it would be very good for Old Town and good for me if you had a Pendry and a Montage Hotel there, and you had those kind of people there paying $2,000 or $3,000 a night and or leasing the homes there, they would be definitely customers at Old Town, because people, when they come on vacation, they don't stay at the hotel all the time. We have a great relationship with La Quinta Resort. You know, they have their own restaurants and shops, but still people want to go to somewhere else nearby.
They want to be off property.
So I've always been very supportive of Silver Rock, but it's been terribly handled, frankly. It's just been terribly handled, and I think it's going to be in bankruptcy or undeveloped for, you know, many more years. They think they're going to get it going and out of bankruptcy by Christmas. I mean, that's what, you know, both Linda, the mayor, and the city manager, John, have told me. But I suspect until the lenders are willing to eat like $200 million and write off $200 million of debt, which most lenders aren't going to do easily, that it's, and also I think it probably has to be completely bulldozed, which is environmentally a disaster and economically a disaster, because I suspect what has been built there is just, you know, rusted. I mean, literally the nails are rusted.
Wow.
So I think it's going to have to be bulldozed. I think it was ill-conceived. I don't generally, despite Indian Wells did an amazing job of developing the golf courses there, the Hyatt and the Esmeralda, and it provides...
Jack Oliphant had a lot to do with that.
And it provides huge, yeah, but it provides huge income for Indian Wells. It's their main source of income, because they don't really have, you know, they have property taxes, of course, and sales tax, but it provides so much TOT. The TOT rate, occupancy, is 12.5% in Indian Wells.
Because it's a small, I mean, it's the smallest city. I mean, they're only, what, 5,000 residents?
Billionaires.
But they have some
bucks. Millionaires. But anyway, so the city of La Quinta wanted to emulate that, but it's a different time and place. Costs are, you couldn't build, you know, you could give them the land now. You couldn't build the Esmeralda and the Hyatt and make it make sense. I mean, in fact, the Hyatt went, I believe it went bankrupt at one time, you know, and so, and that was built, I believe, originally by Charlie Passerell and,
yeah,
and Ray Moore, who former neighbors and friends, and our kids were friends, etc. But
and instrumental in putting together one of the greatest tennis tournaments, you know, in the world.
Well, they had put it together before that. It started at La Quinta. La Quinta unfortunately lost it. Maybe shouldn't have. And Indian Wells, if you will, you know, got them to build the hotel, and they originally it moved to the Hyatt. But I think at some point the Hyatt, you know, a lot of hotels here, a lot of projects have gone through bankruptcy or their problems. I mean, the Valley unfortunately is fairly cyclical.
It is cyclical, and you know we're a tourism community, so when times are tough, they're pretty tough on us, because when people stop traveling,
well, and that's what people are worried about right now. People are going to, you know, stop traveling domestically? Are the Canadians going to stop coming, etc.? So, well, I think the Canadians already have stopped coming, or they're leaving.
It's true.
Well, they still can.
We've done a couple of stories where the Canadian carriers are 70% down. I think that's flights across the United States, but, you know, that is a huge impact on us because of our enormous Canadian snowbird population. So,
is there something about, in your opinion, La Quinta over the years? I mean, I watched over the last few years how there was a race to put a gas station on the corner of 50th and Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Indio got it. La Quinta didn't, which means Indio's got all that tax revenue and such. For a city that has gone through the whole Silver Rock thing, they needed a developer like you who could individually put together Old Town. Is there something about that city that has kept them from being even better than they could have been?
I think it's a lack of leadership from the highest level of the city council. I mean, they lost the... There was supposed to be an Albertsons, or one time it was a Pavilions on the corner of 50th and Jefferson. Then that never got built because they made them redesign it like 8 times. And I think it, you know, you need to design something nicely. So maybe there was fault with the developer. But then, you know, a couple years ago, there should have been the Surf Park was going to be built, but they folded because the residents nearby complained about it, you know, even though it was a permitted use in that zone. So we have no Surf Park. The Surf Park is going to be in Palm Desert instead. And if it's kind of a little tidbit, if you are a real aficionado of these things, but if you go to the Ralphs at 50th and Jefferson, and you, when you're getting your card out, you look up, they have a picture of a downtown painted on the wall. I mean, like a photo that's kind of been painted on the wall. It's a picture of Old Town La Quinta in Indio, and it has a banner painted on there. It says, "Welcome to Indio." So Indio uses a picture of Old Town La Quinta to depict their downtown. At least Ralph's did.
Right.
The city may not have been involved. But yeah, that Ralph's, I mean, when I lived in the Cove, or I do live in the Cove still, I mean, you know, I used to always go to that Ralph's because it was the nearest really nice grocery store.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so it's really unfortunate. Yeah, they've lost. And now that, yeah, the gas station went across the street, that was because that was driven by Ralph's,
right,
and the new project there. But yeah, it definitely hurts. It definitely hurts that they just don't seem to have to be able to drive things through, and they just get whipped around by, you know, the neighbor comes in and says, oh, it's going to create noise. Well, yes, development does create noise. The people at Andalusia, who have hundreds of acres of flower beds, hundreds of acres of lakes, said, oh, the water park's going to use water, as if they don't use water. And so the city council, again, just folded on the water park.
But, you know, that was the same argument. And we get a lot of inquiries. I get them because I do weather and people.
You're doing a very good job on the weather, Patrick. I mean, today it's only like 91. I think I've got to commend you.
This is, it's not hot.
So keep it, if you can just keep it like this all summer.
Wouldn't this be phenomenal? You would probably not leave. You just stay here. You know, I think one of the things we get complaints about or questions about Catino and, you know, the giant water feature that they're building there. And I'm always trying to explain to people who write in because they're like, well, how can that possibly, you know, we have a water shortage and this and that. And they're like, they designed their water use within the parameters that were set up. Mm-hmm. You know, they live within the city parameters.
Right.
And so the water park, my understanding was going to do the same thing.
Well, the one in Palm Desert is designed to refill the aquifer. I just saw a presentation that the city manager made the other day on the one in Palm Desert, and it stores water. And they took out something like, I don't want to quote, but 140 acres of turf on their golf courses, of green turf, to provide the water for the water park. So I think that's a good trade-off, because the problem with tourism here is there's, you know, for the kind of young adults and active adults, teens, 20-year-olds, there's, you know, there hasn't been a lot to do. I mean, some of them are definitely golfing, but, you know, we're changing it. They're now biking, they're surfing, they're, you know, they're doing other active sports. So we need to provide something for everyone. Otherwise, you know, the teenagers don't want to come here, then the parents won't come.
Right. Well, trust me, I have teenagers, and they live part-time in L.A., and you know, we have to do stuff to lure them out here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then exactly. After school, they decide to move somewhere where they can find something to do.
Yeah.
And we want them to stay here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you need that. I mean, you can't just have a community of people that are, you know, waiting for, you know, the next life.
Right. How fortunate
that
did you...
That felt really personal.
I think it was intended that way. He was looking at you when he said it. How fortunate did you feel in working with the city council at the time to get Old Town approved?
Well, they were very supportive. And then about 6 years ago, I went back to the Planning Commission and the city council, and I was going to build on city-owned land all the land that's between Old Town and the Civic Center campus, the library and the Civic Center campus on 3.5 acres I had under contract with the city. I was going to build another 10,000 square feet of commercial. I have 103,000 now, but so a small bit of commercial along the continuation of Main Street. And I was going to build 86 condos. And they, you know, they loved it. They unanimously approved it. I just could never finance it because there's nothing else like it in the valley here. And the big boys, as I call them, in L.A. and Orange County or New York, you know, they're very formulaic. And you have to prove that there's other projects around you.
So to be the first is a hard thing.
Yes, if you're a Sooner, as they call them in Oklahoma, you know, they say that the pioneers end up with arrows in their backs. And I also, one of my favorite expressions is really, you know, if a project like Old Town works, they call you a visionary, that you had the vision to develop this downtown. If it doesn't work, they just call you bankrupt. And so, you know, Silver Rock is bankrupt. Right. If it had worked, they would call it everybody. They would have said it was very visionary, like they now say about the, you know, prescient or visionary, the city council and the people in Indian Wells. They say, oh, they were visionary to build these two great golf courses and build these great hotels that provide so much income for Indian Wells. But if it hadn't worked out, they would call the city bankrupt.
Yeah. It's very true. Very true.
How much was La Quinta... Or more, was it impacted more than any other city in the area by the loss of the EDAs, the Economic Development Agencies?
I don't know if it was affected any more or less than other cities. They had kind of gorged themselves on it. They used, right. tax increment financing money from mostly from the development of PGA West, which has been agricultural zone. So all the extra property taxes created by the by when Landmark Land built PGA West and all the thousands of houses there, they use that to spend, you know, $55 million to buy Silver Rock from KSL, because KSL had tried to do a very high-end development just like the city has proposed in the last 10 years. And they took it, and Larry Lichtleiter himself, who was the L in KSL, told me that they took it back to Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts in New York, who were their benefactors, if you will, their partners, and they asked for $1 billion. It was probably what it would take to develop that site, and they literally got laughed out of the conference room. So, you know, the city should have learned something. They could have. They don't have any collective memory. They should have. They could have learned something from the people that own that. That's why KSL sold it, because it was impossible to develop a high-end.
Or they would have built it.
They would have built it.
Right.
And so they sold it for $55 million. I remember, again, at the time, at Rotary, the former mayor, Don Adolph, telling me, I said, why did you spend $55 million? Oh, well, even if we don't develop it, we'll just resell it at a profit. Well, of course, they never did, and they can't.
Right.
I've learned so much more about my own city.
See?
This is awesome.
This has been awesome.
Well, it's probably all getting me in a lot of trouble with the mayor and the city council, but, you know.
They're not big listeners.
I'm not they're not looking to develop anything else there at this point, so.
So, you have such an interesting background, and your dad was a diplomat, and you thought about doing that. But now you get to spend time in Greece, and you get to spend. So where are some of your favorite places when you were out of the Coachella Valley?
Well, I love Paris. I lived in Paris for 2 years. My daughter is an architect in Paris, and she's married to a Frenchman. She got married a year and a half ago. So I love Paris. My wife and I just got remarried almost 2 years ago, and she is originally from Poland, but she grew up in Canada, so I definitely have heard a lot on the Canadian side from my in-laws about, you know, what's happening currently with the Canadians. And, you know, I mean, it's just so unfortunate. I mean, the Canadians are the nicest people in the world, you know, probably right even ahead of maybe the British. I mean, they're just, I don't think there are very few Canadians that have any mean moan in their body. So it's very odd that they got picked on, I guess,
yeah.
All I can say.
It is very strange. It is very strange. And you're going to be spending some... How much time do you spend in Greece?
We spend about 4 months a year. Uh-huh. And I'm buying a hotel there and developing property there because it's, frankly, a lot easier to do there than it is here.
Really?
You need to do a remote for the opening of the hotel in
Big
Greece.
Conversations on Leros. I see it.
Well, I'm also. I tried to buy the hotel across from Old Town last month, the Embassy Suites. That didn't work out. I think they're taking it back off the market. In fact, the city was unaware that it was for sale. It had been for sale a couple months. And then I'm now working on trying to buy the Indian Wells Resort Hotel.
Oh.
In Indian Wells.
A classic property, Desi Arnaz.
Right.
Such exactly. History there.
It's huge history, and we would like to turn it into a tribute by Marriott. We have other Marriott hotels. So we'd like to turn it into what it's called. It's one of the Marriott brands. It's called Tribute, yeah. Where you're, you know, paying tribute to some architectural element or people or an era. And there's a lot of history there. It needs a lot of work, a lot of renovation. So that's the big bugaboo. And there's also another 7 acres next to it. So I had a nice...
Oh, yeah, there's a huge lot.
Yeah, over toward Tommy Bahama. So I had a great meeting last week with Chris, the city manager of Indian Wells, and their economic development director. Trying to, you know, and they're planning to do a huge new development, whether it's a montage, well, it's probably not a montage, it's probably a Rosewood or a Four Seasons on Miles and 111. So they have a 221 room, I believe it's 221, and a huge project there, which is going to be like 80 feet high and have underground parking. And they're, you know, a company called Summit Development out of Orange County is going ahead with that. So that will... Although it brings a lot more hotel rooms, we think it will bring a lot of visibility to the valley, as Montage and Pendry would have, because if you build hotels of that caliber and you're spending $1 billion or $800 million or whatever it is, you have to do a lot of marketing. And so, and the Greater Palm Springs Visitors Bureau does a great job, but there's nothing like all that extra private money to drive people here.
No. Oh. This has been fascinating.
It really has been.
I have learned an awful lot.
I'm going to stay in La Quinta. Might end up being mayor.
Before
someday.
We wrap up, what is your... I think you have a really good finger on the pulse here, even as we go through, obviously, these tumultuous times.
What do you look at as the economic outlook for the Valley in the next 10 years?
I don't have any original insight. I did go to the 4th District of the Riverside County. Manuel Perez is the supervisor for this area.
Yeah.
His offices are at Old Town, and I went to his State of the Valley seminar on last Thursday, I guess it was. And so, I am more positive than a lot of people. I mean, I don't think we do have some turmoil in the stock market and the bond market and stuff, but it's all self-inflicted, and it's nothing that can't be reversed. It's not like some, like COVID or anything like that.
Right.
And I even have a theory. If some of the Canadians, I wouldn't blame them if they now sold their houses here, but they're not going to take their houses with them unless they're motor coaches, but most of them aren't. They can't move the house. So that will get resold to somebody, whether it's somebody from Newport Beach or Orange, other places in Orange County, L.A., San Diego, Chicago, Portland, whatever.
And the property taxes will still be paid here.
Yes, and actually they'll go up because a lot of the Canadians bought it just at the right time. And now, the Canadian dollar is so weak that I wouldn't blame them for repatriating those U.S. dollars, converting them back into Canadian dollars, and then they'll go to Mexico or Cuba. They're allowed to go to Cuba or other places to vacation, but those people will be replaced. And even the people who aren't coming on those flights that were canceled, then, those opens up hotel rooms for other people who come. So I'm not sure, as unfortunate as it is, that it will have really that much of an economic effect. I know it's a good story, but I think actually, whenever there's a void, it gets filled.
Well, I agree. I mean, if they choose not to come for a period of time, but they continue to own the home, then they're not here spending money. But if they decide to sell the property, it is not a long-term. Well,
my experience with Canadians is they're very frugal. So the chance of them leaving their house, either they're going to rent it out and get income off
they're
it, means they're going to be somebody else in that house,
right,
who's going to be spending money here,
going out to
or they're
going to
sell the house. But they're not being as frugal as they are, because most of them immigrated originally from Scotland to Canada. They will not leave it vacant just despite the Americans.
right.
And I probably have gotten myself in trouble. I do love the Canadians, but they are very frugal. So they may be replaced, if I'm a business owner, I would say they might be replaced by people who are less frugal. We hope.
That's always the hope. Well, Marvin, thank you so much.
This has been really
I feel
great.
Like we've only scratched the surface.
Definitely.
Here. I feel like there's a lot more we could learn from
you
this.
You need to spend more time with me at Old Town.
Yes. Thank you, Patrick. Yeah, we'd love to see you out there.
Well, one of the things I wanted to touch on really quickly, one of the things, and we talked about this prior to starting, we met many times, but I think we spent more time together talking about Old Town Artisan Studios when it was in residence in Old Town. Now they're adjacent, but that's a charity that I really love, and it's really grown.
Right. And you've been very supportive of it. And the reason it's called Old Town Artisan Studio is the Victory and Dick Grund, who started it, are investors in Old Town. And I gave them, very inexpensive space when we had a bunch of vacancies. And then as we got fewer and fewer vacancies, I kept upping their rent. And so they ended up moving out. But they took the name with them.
They did. But they only moved a couple of blocks. So
they're still very, very close friends.
Yeah, they're dear, dear people. And it's a great organization. So, and it got its start there in Old Town. So,
right.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. This has been terrific.
Thank you.
My thanks to Randy Florence. Always great job.
Great to be here.
So nice to hang out with you.
I'm staying in La Quinta.
All right, see? I knew there was a good reason just to do this one interview.
I was this close to Cat City.
I know. My thanks to John McMullen, our producer. I'm Patrick Evans. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode of Big Conversations Little Bar. Our thanks to the McCallum Theater and for Skip Page, their support and sponsorship. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Big Conversations Little Bar.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations Little Bar. Recorded on location at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, and presented by the McCallum Theater, online at mccallumtheater.org. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. All episodes are available from BigConversationsLittleBar.com and most major podcast portals.
Meet your neighbors, fascinating and grand. Each conversation, a wave on the sand.
Raise your glass and join the ride, where stories and dreams fully collide. At Big Conversations Little Bar, brought to you by McCallum, our guiding star. From movie stage and TV's delight, join us for a captivating morning, noon, or night. So gather round at Skip's Little Bar, where stories travel from near and far. Big conversations where they unfold, with Patrick and Randy, tales retold.